Good evening, welcome. You are listening to The Cave. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson alongside Alex Stiv. We have lots to talk about this evening. Inflation, certainly one of the key narratives we'll be focusing on. But right now, Alex, I'm looking at a pretty ugly sell-off. The Nasdaq down by 3.35%. The S&P down by 2.9%. Can we blame Target for all of this?
I mean, it feels like maybe you can blame a little bit of Target, but you know, that's not why the NASDAQ 100 is down by over 3%. It does feel like the sell-off that we had on Thursday took a break for a while, and then we had all the bear market rally talk. Have we really seen capitulation? And the narrative over the last 24 hours is like, no, we haven't seen capitulation yet. Things are still super tough.
Absolutely. We're going to talk much more about this a little bit later on in the program. Let's get an update now on the headlines. Here's Charlie Powell.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Road fuel prices in the UK are at new records today, fanning roaring inflation despite a government effort to temper soaring costs for motorists. The RAC motoring organization says average gasoline prices climbed to 167.64 pence a litre at the pump yesterday from a previous high of 167.3 pence. Diesel hit 180.88 pence, its third record in 4 days. Britain's worst bout of inflation in 40 years, quickly becoming a crisis for both Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government and the Bank of England. The central bank is in the eye of the storm after consumer prices surged 9% in the year through April. Cabinet ministers, economists, and even a former BOE boss are complaining that Governor Andrew Bailey was too slow to act and is failing in keeping his job to keep inflation to 2%. More than 85% of UK finance workers no longer view the office as their main place of work, highlighting the challenge the industry faces as it tries to persuade bankers to return to pre-pandemic norms. According to a YouGov survey of more than 500 finance executives from across the UK, commissioned by Bloomberg News, just 14% now consider the office their main workplace, compared to 42% for the home and 44% for a hybrid arrangement. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson back in the office. Back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. So let's kind of pick up on what Charlie's been talking about. UK inflation rising to its highest level since Maggie Thatcher was Prime Minister. It was 1982.
What hairstyle did you have, by the way? I have been resisting myself for days. What hairstyle did you have in
1982? I was 1982, I was what, 11 years old?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a particularly stylish sort of level of fashion that I was dealing with at that point. I'm not
probably
sure
not.
I am now. I think it was a fairly basic haircut. I can remember 1982 quite well because the Falklands War was on. I remember Thatcher being in power. I actually weirdly remember that year quite well. Now I'm in my early 50s and so I was kind of 10, 11 at that point. But yeah, no, it was, I don't remember the economics. I remember the geopolitics, which kind of is a little bit sort of maybe symmetrical with what we're seeing right now as well, another war being fought. But yeah, consumer prices are super high. They look like they're going to go a little bit higher from here. This time 6 months ago, the Bank of England was talking about inflation being half what it is now, i.e. the Bank of England is well behind the curve. So we've got 1% interest rates. We've got 9% inflation. That is a bit of a problem. Reid Landberg joining us now from our UK economics team. Reid, the magnitude of what we're seeing here and how badly wrong economists, the Bank of England, the government have got this. This feels like a huge, huge problem for the UK that nobody really seems to have their arms around right now. Everybody's pointing the finger at everybody else. The Chancellor's saying it's international, it's fuel prices. The Bank of England yesterday, the governor was kind of pointing at everybody, but not himself. Nobody's taking responsibility for this.
Well, it's huge numbers, and it's a huge change in the economy, and it's not something that the Bank of England could see all of. What's really driving inflation this time around? Energy bills up 54% in April. That's because the government allowed a price cap to reset, reflecting wholesale prices in the market. That's down to the war in Ukraine. It's down to a pinch in the gas market. The central bank is good at many things, but foreseeing a war is not one of them. So that's one of the things they're looking at. But you're absolutely right. It's huge changes. The higher price of energy is seeping through into food and drink prices, up 6.7% from a year ago in April. of the cost of culture and recreation up 6%, the cost of restaurant and hotels up 8% from a year ago, furniture 10.7%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any end in sight, or maybe a better way of asking this question is, what does a peak look like?
A peak, the Bank of England says, is going to be 10% or more, and it'll probably come in October when, again, those energy bills are allowed to reset. You know, in the U.S., you're looking at inflation maybe already peaking. They're not talking about it peaking here until later in the year.
The bank, though, sounds quite cautious. And the fear has to be, presumably, that this kind of inflation becomes embedded. And I know the bank models are actually predicting that inflation falls fairly quickly. And this was actually the first time in quite a long time that actually inflation number didn't come in above expectations. But nevertheless, we continuously seem to be in a position where inflation is stickier than anticipated. Are we in danger of inflation expectations becoming unanchored from a consumer point of view? Because that's when we get into this danger of a wage price spiral.
Well, the bank says no, that inflation expectations are anchored at the moment. And their chief hawk, Michael Saunders, who's been pushing for higher rates for quite some time, he thinks that inflation expectations are anchored at the moment. But that is in the back of their mind. That is a concern out there. And the issue is, there's a lot of things the bank just doesn't know. Will we make peace with Russia and go back to having gas flowing freely? That would loosen up inflation quickly. But what happens if we don't? What happens if the situation escalates? That's something the bank just doesn't know and can't tell.
So I guess then the question is, what are the knock-on effects of that? Because if the Bank of England doesn't really know, we don't know what inflation expectations are going to do. Presumably, utility costs are going to re-rate higher in the fall also, and then it's going to get cold. What happens to the UK economy? Like, what does Guy's family do? Like, do you guys huddle in blankets with no heat for the winter?
That's my plan.
That was your plan
last year. Now you got to have a different plan.
We're not quite there yet. Governor Andrew Bailey is saying what the bank needs to do is respond to the data, respond to developments in the economy as they come. So the central expectation is that growth is going to slow up from here, and that slower growth will take some of the wind out of inflation. If that happens, it's good news. We may muddle through.
But what the bank seems to be relying on is this idea that high inflation is going to kill demand. That's a pretty painful policy mix for the consumer.
It is indeed, but the first priority for the bank is to make sure that inflation is under control. That's their prime mandate. And they look back at the lessons of the 70s and 80s and think, that's the one thing we absolutely must be sure of, make sure inflation is under control, whether there's a recession or not. That seems to be the implicit signal coming out of their last report.
Well, I mean, I don't know, Guy. Have you guys started making any changes in terms of how you are allocating stuff?
So just anecdotally, yes, I know people are certainly changing shopping habits. I hear about this on a daily basis. My wife tells me about it all the time. And when I go shopping at the weekend for groceries, you can see it. It's really clear. The prices are rising pretty quickly, as are holidays, as are cars, as are everything else. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of how quickly behavior changes from here. I think you're starting to see some evidence of that. In fact, we're going to talk about that next. Andrea Felstead is going to be joining us. Is the consumer about to crack? Reid, thank you very much indeed. Reid Lamberg, this is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
So let's get the read on how people are going to change their spending habits. Guy was saying that they're already looking at that. You go to the grocery store, you're already feeling it. Here in the U.S., I feel it too. You go out to dinner, you get a bowl of pasta and a non-alcoholic drink, and you're shelling out like $135. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. It's getting pretty brutal over here too. Let's get the read-through then in terms of the actual consumer and what they're buying in stores. Andrea Felstead, a Bloomberg Opinion, joins us now in the UK studio. Andrea, I got to tell you, if I'm paying $135 for a bowl of pasta and like a salad, I'm not going to go buy a pair of jeans. What are we seeing?
Exactly. That is exactly what we're seeing. I've just been covering the Walmart and Target results. Walmart was saying yesterday that people are spending more on food. And so they are diverting more of their spending away from those, more of their spending towards essentials and away from those things that are nice to have, such as clothing and home furnishings. We're seeing exactly that.
We all bought a lot of home furnishings during lockdown. I'm not sure we need any more of those. But clothing is a high-margin business. It's going to hit the retailers pretty hard. And that's certainly what we're seeing at the moment with some of these businesses. Is the consumer, though, at the point where they're starting to crack? How close to that point do you think we are where actually the consumer says, I've had enough?
I think we are seeing some signals that are flashing a warning sign that the consumer is starting to retrench. Now, the difficulty we've got, as you just mentioned, we all bought a lot of home furnishings, is this is all being caught up with some of those pandemic changes. So it's difficult to disentangle what is caused by pressure on wallets and what is caused by changing lifestyle. So for example, as you mentioned, home furnishing, that is one of the areas where we're seeing the biggest retrenchment. Big expensive items usually get hit when incomes come under pressure, prices are rising, but also we bought a lot of it. So it's that funny sort of mix. We don't really know what the underlying cause is. Now clothing, it's a similar picture, buying less casual clothing, but we're still buying party dresses and high-heeled shoes because everybody's going to weddings, parties, socializing. So we've also got this switch going on. So it's really difficult to know exactly what is happening to the consumer.
I'm doing none of those things. And also, my husband was very happy when I stopped buying throw pillows. I do have to say that the home goods sector needs to take a break.
Well. And
shoes. So Andrea, walk me through so far what we've noticed. Who is this good for? Who is this bad for in terms of retailers? Because what you're describing means that we should all be going out and buying Louis Vuitton stuff, but not our sweatpants.
Exactly. What we're starting to see, consumer confidence is crumbling. That's the first thing we've seen. McKinsey did some research and found that consumers were at peak pessimism. They were most downbeat about the UK recovery since March 2020. There's quite an interesting thing going on with restaurants. We've seen a bit of a slowdown in hospitality in April since Easter. So that's a bit of a warning sign as well. And again, home furnishings very much in the forefront of what's happening in retail sales. The McKinsey research was also very interesting because it showed more people were buying private label brands at supermarkets rather than big brands, and the private label brands tend to be cheaper, and also more people were going back to those German discounters Aldi and Lidl, which is also something we've been seeing in some other data.
I've just got a minute on this. Walmart and Target are two of the best management teams out there.
Yeah.
If they're screwing up, what does that tell us?
I think it tells us it's going to be very difficult for the retailers, for US retailers going forward. We've got this inventory build up. You know, they were doing the right things, trying. There was all that outcry about nobody could find things. They chartered their own ships. They made sure they had products. In March, the consumer retrenched unexpectedly. That meant they had more product and they're having to mark it down. If we see that there, we're going to see it places like the department stores.
Yes, Andrea, please, markdowns. I'll take it.
And she's back shopping.
Didn't take very much.
I'm sure it probably won't. That shoe count has to rise. Andrea, great piece on the Bloomberg today. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Andrea Felstead. Up next, we're going to talk to the idea that the EU is looking to make an energy transition. That story next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. So, Alex, today the EU, the European Union, unveiling a whole kind of raft of measures basically designed to accelerate the move away from Russian energy. Ursula von der Leyen announcing a €210 billion plan, basically designed to cut red tape, to allow wind and solar to move more quickly, to make renewables more attractive. Basically, the idea is that we need to move away from Russian energy and we need to do it quickly. This is basically supercharging the green energy deal that the EU largely already had in place. It needs to do it more quickly now, but it's a hugely heavy lift.
So Removing red tape is always good for these things, particularly stuff like wind and solar that does need infrastructure to go along with it. My question, though, becomes each country is dealing with different problems, right? Like France relies more on nuclear. Spain imports a lot of LNG. So you need to find a way to get that LNG to different areas of Europe. Germany retired those coal plants, but you need to start them up in the short term. So that each country has all these individual problems and bottlenecks. So on a country level, can they manage it?
Well, I think that's the problem. And how do you manage this on a short-term, medium-term basis? Because right now, getting away from Russian energy is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And the temptation must be at this point to spend on things like regasification plants for LNG so that we can import more LNG into the EU from places like the United States. But do you want to spend the money on that right now? Probably not if mm-hmm. you're looking kind of with your eyes towards the horizon of a kind of lower carbon economy.
Well, at the same time, these utility companies are going to have contracts that are already out months and years. I don't know. It depends on the contract terms. But they're going to have that. So they can't. Why would, say, a utility company go and get offtake agreement from the U.S. when they're already paying Russia to do the same thing, like just in case? I mean, then they're paying for two contracts. They have to wait for they actually do need a sanction to come down and kill that contract so they can go out and buy other stuff. So even so, they're kind of sitting under their hands.
Yeah, I think that I from what I understand, I think they're less concerned about that in as much as if there was a break with the Russian gas, then I think it would be, as you say, largely driven by governments. And government is going to be putting these new these new supply plans in place. We're seeing certainly the U.S. contracts being pushed at a fairly high level. But the danger is that you end up spending a lot of money on a regasification plant when you're not going to need it in 10 years' time.
Exactly.
So the whole idea is that you maybe rent, lease some short-term kind of floating regasification plants, hopefully to get you through this. But even that is massively problematic. So it's a huge heavy lift. The European Union relies 40%, circa 40%, on Russian gas. If that gets turned off tomorrow, there is still a major problem. This plan is not going to solve that in the short term.
Which then I think we have to go back to the demand destruction story. Like, are we going to have a situation? So let's just pretend that Russian gas gets shut off or something along those lines happens.
Yep.
This takes a long time. You can't just put a turbine in the next 2 minutes. No. So then you have to have rationing. And then what does that do to, say, factory output? Because can a factory run like it's used to or no? And then what does that do to the economy?
Well, it's going to be, you talk about rationing, which I think is really interesting. So are we at the point now where we should already be rationing? And it doesn't need to be enforced rationing, but it needs to be educated rationing, i.e. should governments be out there at the moment saying to the population, don't drive as fast, turn the thermostat down, watch what's happening with the air conditioning. Small changes can have a huge impact in terms of what is happening here. Let's go to Brussels now. John Ainge is standing by to give us his take on this. John, I'm really curious to get your take. We have a potentially short-term problem and a medium-term problem in Europe. Ursula von der Leyen announcing today's plan, which basically sort of supercharges the green transition. But is it going to be quick enough and effective enough to deal with the problem we currently have with Russian energy and the risks surrounding it?
I think the short answer to that is no. I think the green elements of this plan that was announced today is going to be a few years off. There's new elements such as permitting for wind farms and solar. The EU wants to make a massive push on putting solar panels on buildings. And that does have huge potential, but that's something that's going to come down the line. In the short term, this year, the EU wants to reduce its dependency on Russian gas by 2/3. Most of that is going to come from LNG from other countries, other sources. And as we know, LNG is not great for the environment. It comes with greenhouse gas emissions. So I think in the short term, we are going to see a rise in the EU's carbon footprint.
Do they have to bring back coal in some capacity?
Yes, that's certainly an element.
And those optics are not good.
the climate chief, Frans Timmermans, he has said a few times over the last few weeks that there should be no taboos when it comes to ditching Russian energy. And of course, some of that is going to be coming from coal. We have seen coal burnt in record amounts globally, and I think that is going to be the same in the EU, in the likes of Germany, for example. But there's other short-term solutions that EU countries are looking at. For example, Belgium is prolonging the life of a couple of nuclear reactors. So really, there's nothing off the table.
What can the EU do in terms of importing more gas? How easy is it to hire right now floating regasification plants? Because presumably what you need here is a sort of short-term fix that will allow you then to focus on the longer-term problem.
Well, that's exactly it. Yes, there are these short-term floating plants, but they still take a while to install, obviously. And it's not cheap just getting the gas off the market. LNG is more expensive at the best of yeah. times, but you have to remember the EU is competing with the likes of China for some of these supplies. So the EU did announce a deal with the US a month or so ago for 15 billion cubic meters more, but that might not be enough for the EU's needs.
I love that, Guy, you're talking about modular regasification facilities. That means so much
Your
to me.
Your work here is done.
Thank you.
John, thanks very much indeed. John Ager joining us from Brussels. This is cool.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, everybody. You're listening to The Cable. I'm Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. We have a brutal, ugly, gross day happening within the U.S. equity market. Tech is now up by over 3%. The downturn sort of picked up a lot of steam once Target's numbers came out. They had to readjust their profit forecast because of rising costs and some discounting from higher inventory, and that really weighed on the market. Target down 24%. But as the day went on, we really picked up some more steam to the downside. Tech also taking it on the chin. A big, nice move coming into the bond market, particularly on the back end. You have yields up by about 7 basis points. So a lot happened in there. And Target now down the most since 1987. Now, Guy, in 87, I had this, like, silk fuchsia pink Minnie Mouse jacket. It was amazing. I just want to put that out there.
Okay. I'm not entirely sure how to follow that.
You can't, because it was just too awesome. It was just, it was shiny and sparkly. It was like a bomber jacket and a huge picture of Minnie Mouse's head on the back.
1987, yeah. I think, David Bowie, kind of, yeah, that was kind of that era. Howard Jones, kind of some of that stuff knocking around. Maybe a little earlier, actually. Yeah, maybe 1987.
Pink jacket.
Some good music at that point.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the choice of clothing, but the music was good.
I would probably wear it again at this point. For some reason. All right, Charlie Pellet, you got some headlines.
Exactly. I just want to.
Can you beat that?
No, I've got to agree with Guy Johnson on the music of that era. It was great. But I tell you, I look good in the clubs in my Mickey Mouse jacket back then. Here's what's going on. Finland, Sweden handing in their formal applications to join NATO, but the process could drag out as Turkish President Erdogan blocks the alliance from starting the accession process, making clear he is frustrated with the approach of several alliance members to Kurdish groups. The European Union, meanwhile, is proposing to spend as much as 12 billion euros, 10.1 billion pounds, to help fund the infrastructure needed to end its reliance on Russian energy as part of a larger clean energy package, but the bloc does remain stuck on negotiations to sanction oil from Moscow. All of this as the European Union unveils a raft of measures ranging from boosting renewables and LNG imports to lowering energy demand in its quest to cut dependence on Russian supplies. Norwegian gas sales are on course to test a record for this year as Europe seeks to reduce its dependence on Russian supplies as soon as possible. The continent's second biggest supplier is pumping at full tilt, benefiting from record prices and higher demand than ever for its fuel. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
Charlie Pellet, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Want to get some more on that NATO headline. So you had Finland and Sweden handing in their application to join NATO, but it looks like Turkish President Recep Erdogan is still planning to block, if not had already blocked, the alliance from actually going forward. Let's get the details now. Roz Matheson joins us on the phone. Roz, has Turkey officially blocked this and said no?
Not well. This was a bit unsurprising in a way, because this was just the very beginning of the process to get Sweden and Finland on the board to be considered for NATO membership. It's not, and so it's not surprising in a way that Turkey stepped in this early and said, hang on, we're not prepared to let this go any further just yet, because of course Turkey has got no concessions so far, and they're demanding quite a bit from both Finland and Sweden, and quite possibly the US and other NATO alliance members, in order to sort of get out of the way and allow this to happen. So it's probably because at this point they're still putting out there, they're sort of like stalling away for what they want to get in return for allowing this, and just saying, we're not going to oppose it, but we're certainly at least going to very much slow it down until we can discuss this further.
The support at the issue at the moment seems to be Scandinavian support for the Kurdish rebels. Is that really what the problem here is, or is it something else?
Well, it is actually a very fundamental issue for Turkey, and certainly for President Erdogan. He sees these the Kurdish rebels, particularly the militant part of it, as sort of something that is an existential threat, really, to Turkey. Says that these rebels come into Turkish territory and launch attacks and so on. And so for him, it's actually quite a serious issue, and he sees Sweden in particular as being a vocal supporter of the Kurdish movement over the years, both diplomatically, financially, and he says militarily, Finland to a lesser extent. So for him, it is actually a true issue, but this is the one opportunity he really gets to perhaps like get some results out of that. He's been saying this for years to not much avail, really, but now he's got NATO, you know, needing something from him in return. And so it's unsurprising to see him try and tie the things together.
So, but to Guy's point, okay, he can still be mad about that, but if the U.S. sold him the weapons that he really wanted, or if something else went down, would he be then all of a sudden more okay?
Quite possibly. I mean, the thing he's actually asking for is for Sweden and Finland to crack down much more on Kurds and to actually condemn the Kurdish movement. And he also wants Sweden and Finland to lift their arms embargo, because they don't export weapons to Turkey because they're concerned they'll end up in Syria in the wrong hands. And he says, if we're all a member of NATO, then you need to be able to ship weapons to every different member of the alliance. So those are two very specific things he wants from the Nordic pair. But also, you can imagine that if the US comes in with some sweeteners, particularly on a bunch of the weaponry he's been asking for some time, that might help defray his reticence, you could say, in this case. So it'll be interesting to see, the leaders of Sweden and Finland are both in the US tomorrow meeting the US president. Do they come and say to him, on our behalf, can you please agree to offer some more weapons to Turkey to get this over the line?
What is the danger here for Turkey? What does overplaying its hand look like? Turkey can't be kicked out of NATO, but it can be marginalized.
It can indeed. And also, it does have a long shopping list of weapons that Erdogan has been asking the US for a very long time. On top of that list is F-35 fighters, which are very, very difficult. But he also wants replacement parts for F-16s, and he's been agitating for that for a while, and a bunch of other stuff. So you can certainly see a case where the US says, we can't sell you anything because you stood in the way of this NATO enlargement. And so there is some risk for him, at least in that. There's also the risk that he's seeing, whether or not he likes it, as being therefore aligned very much with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, when it comes to things like Ukraine. You're either in one camp or the other. You're supporting European nations in this, or you're not. So there's the risk that he's also been on the back burner diplomatically with a bunch of countries, including the US.
Just quickly, procedurally, can we just pretend that Turkey comes out and says, I'm saying no to this? What actually then happens after that?
Well, nothing can happen if they say no, because it's one of those things where every single alliance member has to say yes. So the application then in that case goes into the back drawer, at least until or unless they can get Turkish assent. It's one of those things you just can't bypass an alliance member and say, we're going to get it done. The alternative would be to kick Turkey out of NATO in order to get it done, and that's extremely unlikely to happen. So they do hold the cards here in terms of allowing this to move along the line.
The issue with the F-35s was the S-400 missile system, which it bought from Russia. Is Turkey still buying weapons from Russia? Can it still buy weapons from Russia? Is that being closed off to it?
Well, it got the system it wanted from Russia, although it actually really wanted the missile defense system instead from the U.S. So the U.S. administration declined to sell them, so it bought it from Russia instead. But in fact, the interesting thing in this conflict is Turkey's been giving weapons and selling weapons to Ukraine, particularly drones that have been very effective. So I wouldn't imagine there's going to be a long list of military sort of agreements between those countries anytime soon.
Great stuff, Roz. As ever, thank you very much indeed for updating us. We will watch both Finland and Sweden, their leaders, at the White House tomorrow. Should be interesting to see what the optics look like. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. In these tumultuous times when stock markets fall out of bed, rates are moving higher, you have the consumer, lots of question marks, and inflation ramping up, you always want to know what the C-suite thinks, in particular, Wall Street C-suite. And to that, we turn to Shanali Basak, who spoke with David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, yesterday, and got some really interesting insight on the state of the economy and what he thinks. What was your biggest takeaway?
I think what's interesting is we have heard executives here for a while talk about inflation. David Solomon, I go back to an interview I did with him in October, and one of the things he told me then was that it was something that was on the forefront of the minds of all of the big investors he spoke to daily. And now the language he's using is that it's extremely punitive. He said this is in regard to inflation and a potential recession, that in both cases, it's damaging for those that are living paycheck to paycheck, week to week. And therefore, you know, the undertone there is like what this means for disparity in the economy in either direction, whether the Fed causes a recession or whether inflation stays hot.
In terms of kind of what he's watching to see whether or not things are deteriorating and starting to crack, clearly, he has a whole suite of data in front of him. What is he watching in particular to get an idea of kind of what is going on here? What's the canary in the coal mine for him?
What I think is interesting is he's seeing a tightening of monetary conditions, obviously. So is everybody. His clients are preparing for it. He said stock price declines are not surprising. What he's watching for is credit spreads. He said so far it's been pretty orderly, hasn't spilled over into credit spreads, but he's watching it. And if they were to blow out more, it would be concerning. I think that's interesting because, as you know, high yield spreads have been blowing out. So you do see a bit of wiggle room here for what he means about what concerning means.
Do you guys talk more specifically about value at risk, like what their VAR is, like if they need to feel like they need to really stepping back?
This is a good question because we did not talk about it yesterday. However, it is something I've spoke to about with a lot of my sources on background. And therefore, according to tons of people familiar with the matter, Goldman Sachs in particular, as well as other firms, but Goldman Sachs, you know, there's areas in which they are taking risk off the table. You and I have talked about this before, whether that means the SPAC market and investment banking clients. Katie Koch, who you've talked to a lot in the asset management business, has talked about this idea a little bit when it comes to what they are looking to buy or sell in equities. And then I think one of the other big canary in the coal mines will be what happens not just in the U.S. but globally, and how they will handle the issue of emerging markets, which Guy and Alex, I think that we need, you know, Maria Vassallo, who used to work at Soros, is now at Goldman Sachs.
Oh, that's right. She is. Yeah. But she wasn't cleared for media yet.
Oh, we should clear her soon.
We should get her in. Good call.
But yeah, where exactly they're taking risk off the table, I think will be some interesting things to watch because, of course, with the markets, it's always follow the leader here.
David likes a party. Is he going to be taking unlimited holiday?
That's a funny question. He was speaking to Andrew Ostrichman over at CNBC this morning. He was talking about how traditionally Goldman leaders have not taken all their holidays, which is what a lot of this is signaling is for this unlimited holiday policy. But, you know, we've been talking about this a lot, even with unlimited holiday as a policy. And remember, this is only for more senior leaders of the firm. Senior members of the firm, people don't end up taking their holiday. Can I point you guys to one just quick more story that,
please,
I think is under talked about on Wall Street? Is the fact that Jamie Dimon's pay yesterday did not
push back.
Exactly. And it's fascinating for a lot of reasons because it also shows you that the heyday that all these banks have really lived through the last couple of years is just not going to cut it to give these guys special bonuses and higher pay in the face of declining stock prices this year.
Well, particularly as the consumers are the ones that are getting hit. And of all the banks, I mean, Bank of America and JP Morgan, like, they're consumer banks.
And
but, I thought there was a talent war on at the moment.
Well, the thing is that talent war is bound to slow down if activity slows down.
Oh, yeah, good point. Especially if risk-taking slows down.
And if risk-taking slows down. And so if you take a look at the bank stocks, you have Goldman Sachs declining, but less than you see a decline in JP Morgan, to the point that David Solomon was making, inflation will hit lower-income consumers worse.
Shanali, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Always such a pleasure to talk to you. Such a great window into what's going on with Wall Street. Shanali Basak joining us from Bloomberg. Coming up, we'll get more of the horrible target numbers and more insight into how low the stock can go. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
They say the lightning never strikes twice, but when it comes to U.S. retail reporting, let me try and get that out, it seems that it does. Yesterday, we got numbers out of Walmart, and the big shock was that there was an execution problem. Walmart had a margin problem. We saw basically high fuel costs, problems with inventory, squeezing the business pretty hard. So they made a lot of money at the top line, but it got squeezed in the middle of the P&L and didn't drop down to profitability. Everybody thought that it was just a one-off. The Target, the other big box retailer in the United States, would deliver today. Well, it didn't. Target had exactly the same problem, and the stock has been punished. It is down by 25%. A quarter of its value has been wiped out today. It's on pace, basically, if this continues and we don't see a rally into the close, for its worst drop since 1987. 1987, that's Black Monday. That's the Black Monday crash. Everything got battered on that day. Today, things are down, but Target, this is an individual Target story. Greg Malik works over at Evercore. He covers the stock. Alex and I caught up to get his views.
I think the extra 10, 12, 15% out of Target is they just guided in early March, where they were guiding ahead where the street thought. They said their margins could be more than 8% this year. We thought they would guide to something between 7 and 8. And today they basically said, oops, no, the margins are going to be around 6. So I think that's the extra punishment for Target. Frankly, it's probably why it's down 24%, not 12.
Is this a 1-2 quarter phenomenon, Greg, or is this a reset that is going to last longer?
Fingers crossed, if the consumer holds in there as they have been, this should be a 1-2 quarter phenomenon. The real question, this ties into what Walmart and other retailers have started reporting over the last month and even vendors, is are we starting to see trade down? Are we starting to see pressure or any demand destruction from all the inflation that's out there on consumers? And broad speaking, we do expect retail sales to decelerate. We think the second quarter is the trough on a year-over-year basis. So we think we can get through this with strong balance sheets and good job growth. But that is the million-dollar question.
I mean, it seems like, Greg, from what Target and Walmart said, is that the inventories are becoming a problem and that people are spending more on experiences rather than goods and also spending stuff on food and staples versus discretionary, and that's causing that inventory pressure. What happens to that? How deeply do they have to discount, and how do you model it?
It's very industry and category specific. So in areas like home furnishings or electronics, they talked about bicycles, I believe, in your areas of sporting goods. You could have meaningful discounts to get rid of unit inventories that are up even while demand is down. There are other categories where it looks pretty good. And that's where I would say there was a housing shortage out there. Frankly, there's still a car shortage. And that's where pricing is holding them better. So when we're thinking about the stocks to help investors, we're pushing them in that direction as we go through this transition.
Greg, these are two pretty solid management teams. A, how did they screw up so much? And B, if they screwed up, what does it say us about everybody else?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, at the end of the day, Walmart and Target are two of the best. I could say even Amazon, I put them in there. I mean, they had margins down hundreds of basis points year on year. Walmart was down 50 in the U.S. or a little less, 100 globally, and now Target down over 400. So what you're seeing is I think what we had was an unusual period of COVID helping the second quarter of 2020. Then you had those extra stimulus checks that really skewed not only overall demand last March in particular and April, but also the unit demand in certain categories. And so I think a lot of even the best retailers, they may have planned unit inventories down 10% and they should have been down 20. And it's just very hard to know that number.
So, Greg, I know I know you don't cover the company, but TJX was a different story. I mean, they're actually expanding their profit margins. And that really stands out when then you look at the Targets and the Walmarts, for example, as all of them are going to be competing for people and their paychecks. Who else can you see could do this well, and who else will have to be siphoned off into the worst category?
Now, that's a great great call out. My partner Omar Saad covers TJX, but I think that's an area where if they can source more inventory at a lower price and to show that value to the customer, it does sort of play to their business model. But I think another important one is, and this is thematic in a way as we go through this year and into next, we know services are probably going to grow double digits because they shrunk during COVID. So we expect retail goods to grow 5% this year, while services grow double digits and nominal incomes grow 8 or 9. So we expect that share of wallet shift. So as you're looking at retail goods, the question is, which areas is there still a shortage? And which areas do the companies have pricing power, both the vendors, the manufacturers, and the retailers? And so when I look at discretionary, I would focus on home improvement, Home Depot and Lowe's, and then auto parts. We like O'Reilly and some others there as well. So that's the advice we're giving people. Go focus on pricing power and companies that have gained share and traffic over the last few years.
That was Greg Milek of Evercore ISI. He's a 225 price target on Target that looks very far away at the moment. But what I do think is interesting is the constant conversation we're going to have about management. Like, it cannot be that like all retail is going to get screwed and maybe the consumers don't hold in. We're just not seeing that, aka TJX.
Yeah. So here's my take on this. Two of the best management teams in the world, probably two of the best retailers in the world. If they haven't got a clue what's going on, that doesn't say great things about the rest of the industry. But I also wonder about what it says about, for instance, the Fed or the Bank of England's ability to know what's happening. These guys deal with huge amounts of history. They have real-time data. They're probably the most plugged into what is happening with the consumer, and they're misreading the situation. I think that doesn't bode particularly well for central banks.
I guess the good part, though, is that they're not necessarily misreading the consumer. They misread how to manage their costs. So
yeah,
it's not like they ordered a bunch of stuff and everyone stopped buying things. So that's like, that's something.
No, but what they haven't done is position their businesses correctly for the operating environment, which is changing rapidly.
Is a good point. That it happens so fast that if they can't know,
and it's
how
that,
can
precisely,
an economist
it's that
know?
It's that speed. Economists rely on data that comes out every month and every quarter. These guys are dealing with real time, minute by minute, tick by tick data.
And economists are not the fastest people in the world.
No. Yeah. Anyway, hope you enjoy the show. This is Bloomberg.